Marid versus Commonwealth, Samuel C. Moore, Appellants Counsel, Elizabeth K. Fitzgerald, Assistant Attorney General for the Commonwealth.
There we go. Mr. Moore, you may proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I'm Sam Moore, and I represent Appellant Andokolchew Merritt in this case. With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Appellant prevails in this matter because regardless of the application and the standard that is applied, whether that's the community caretaker doctrine, the emergency exception, or reasonableness standard, the officer's unwarranted intrusion into the back closed bedroom door of my client's residence is without authority. Nonetheless, the framework here does matter because it answers the two important questions we have. First, what authority, if any, did officers have to break through my client's front door of his residence and into his private apartment? And then relevant here, particularly second, if the court finds that there is authority to take that action, what authority and what protection do officers then have and possess with them while they're inside the residence? And that framework is essential because this Fourth Amendment practice cannot simply be a retroactive analysis of, well, do we like what we found at the end or do we support the conclusion? It has to be a real-life application of a standard based on objective facts and reasonable, articulable conclusion to be drawn from those facts. In this case, as we briefed, the officers had no warrant, no consent, no exigent circumstances, no plain view, no probable cause, and very relevant and distinguishing about this case, they did not even have a suspicion of criminal activity. This is not a case where
this is Justice Kelsey, if I may interrupt you for a second. But if you go back to first principles, the Fourth Amendment is one of the few provisions of the United States Constitution where elasticity is built in textually. The only searches and seizures that are unconstitutional are unreasonable searches and seizures. And every doctrine, as far as I can tell, that judges have made up, it's been nothing more than a framework to figure out what's reasonable. How in the world could this be unreasonable with a cop comes in and sees a suicide attempt in process and he walks in a couple of steps into another room? He's not going through people's closets or drawers. He's just looking around to see if anyone else is laying on the floor with a knife in him. What is unreasonable about that?
Yes, Your Honor, that question goes to the heart of it, obviously. The Supreme Court has said that the chief evil against which the Fourth Amendment is aimed is the unwarranted intrusion into the home. So I would start with the principle, as the court has suggested, that my client's privacy protection and Fourth Amendment protection is greatest in his home, and the police power to intrude upon that is the least and the most limited. But also to that question, there's two decisions, as I suggested, that are relevant, and I would certainly submit to the court that the Commonwealth's and the police's authority to enter the residence, while we suggest and argue that they did not have that authority, their position is stronger on that. I think based on the facts they have available to them, they certainly are in a better position to enter the residence. But the reason that framework matters is because how they enter into the residence is what tells police and also the court and the practitioners what authority they then had to do anything else. If they enter under a warrant, clearly, they're at their greatest
power. Okay, I'm with you with your explanation, but if I may interrupt again, Judge Petty's opinion for the Court of Appeals references three or four different facts that the Court of Appeals found to make the into that one room reasonable. Someone else might have been subject to violence. They got a guy stabbing himself in the throat in one room. Isn't it reasonable to assume someone else might have been stabbed before they walked in the door? Or maybe someone else is involved. He pointed out that there was a car outside registered to Merritt, and for all they knew, she was in the next room dying of a stab wound. They didn't know that. They also knew they were going to have to, other than Merritt in the next room, they also knew they had to transport this guy eventually to the hospital. They didn't know there weren't any kids in the other room or aged people. Aren't those reasonable things that cops should think about? And what's wrong with that list that the Court of Appeals put together to make it sound reasonable?
Those are facts that the officers, one, did not rely on, did not have in their knowledge and understanding when they took these actions. And two, those facts that the court has listed and that the Commonwealth would submit are conjecture and speculation. And the troubling principle that would be created if it's just too colloquial, but if it's a looser reasonableness standard, then anything is possible. Anything is reasonable. And there's no time that I can come up with as a rational limiting principle in the Fourth Amendment when an officer could say, well, I'm standing right here, wherever it is, whether it's in someone's home, whether it's on the street, whether it's right outside someone's residence, and they say, I don't know what's on the other side of that door. Anything could be there. There could always be someone.
The limiting principle here is they walk into a room and there's some guy trying to kill himself with a knife in the active process of attempted suicide. He's obviously deranged. Everybody in that whole apartment was, if there it was anybody there, would be at risk of a deranged suicide guy. I don't want at all the common sense of this case. I have to admit it to you.
I clearly understand and the court's concern and Your Honor's concern about this principle, but the fact is when they entered the residence, they provided first aid, and the officers quite candidly testified in this case that at that point they were cooling down. They were not amped up, and you know they had adrenaline pumping when they first rescued him, but they were backing down and slowing down and calmed down, and they just did not. I mean, it's one of those where we are constantly told, let's give the police the benefit of the doubt based on their wisdom and experience to say, what does your training tell you about this circumstance? We asked those officers, what did your training tell you about this circumstance? They did not express any concern. They did not express fear. They expressly disavowed it. They said we did not have any reason to believe anyone else, friend, foe, animal, risk, fire, you know, problem was in any other way present in this apartment. And they'd gone in and secured the purpose for their entry into the residence. And that entry was the community caretaker to provide aid. They provided aid. And at that point, their ability to do anything beyond that is limited. And if we were to extend beyond that, we're simply, and the court certainly has, this is not a challenge to the court's authority, but we're simply making law if we extend beyond that. The Community Caretaker Act has not been applied to the residents yet. And then if we go in and say it does, and we're, for the purposes of argument, saying that it certainly might here, what can they do once they've secured the purpose of their visit? Can they go beyond that? Can they perform a protective sweep? I'm not aware of any, there's no case law, there's no statute, there's no support for that applies, particularly where the individual is not arrested, and distinguishing from all of the court's prior precedents, both in Virginia but around the country, where there's other risks, there's other factors. And when they go in and they're worried about guns, when they go in and they're worried about children, when they go in and they're worried about victims, those are all distinguishing factors that simply don't apply in this case.
What about if they go in and they're worried about him having a knife trying to kill himself, and he might have tried to kill anybody else in that apartment?
And I don't want to fight the hypothetical too much, but Your Honor, first, they weren't. But second, I understand it's a reasonable standard and it's not pure based on their subjective mindset. But if that is the standard, anything could apply. And I don't mean that to be too flippant about it. I mean that to mean there are always potential risks on the other side of any door that any law enforcement or government official approaches, again, whether in a residence, whether on the street, whether in a commercial dwelling or building, excuse me. But an individual's privacy protection under the Fourth Amendment is strongest and most secure in the residence. And when they go in,
it seems incredibly ironic that the privacy interest we're talking about is your client's privacy interest, and his only interest is derivative of the tenant, who is not in a good situation at the time the cops show up. Isn't that a little ironic from your perspective? I mean, the question that the Commonwealth raises in their opening brief is whether or not we should even answer this case, because there's no standing the moment the tenant is dead.
Your Honor, my client was a welcome and invited guest to this apartment who lived there for many months, who had a key, who had a right of exclusion to other people. Only recently had the victim moved in the apartment, and I'm not aware of a factor, again, aside from landlord-tenant law as to the end of the lease or the victim's death, affecting or excluding my client's Fourth Amendment protection principles. Again, I can come up with hypotheticals and conjecture and retroactive analysis to get them to, you know, to put those facts together. But what we have are the facts at the scene at the time the officers enter. What legal authority do they have? What facts do they have? And under what framework are they operating?
Let me ask you a hypothetical about your last point. Suppose I go into suppose I am invited into a vehicle and the driver invites me in consensually, and I shoot the driver immediately after being invited in. I shoot him point blank. I could raise a Fourth Amendment standing argument about the search of that vehicle?
If you originally had your Fourth Amendment protection, and if we accept that premise, that as an invited guest into a vehicle, which is obviously a different framework than a home, but if we accept that, yes, you're invited, yes, you have full Fourth Amendment protection in that vehicle, if you commit a crime in that vehicle against the person who gave you permission, I'm not aware of any authority that would revoke your Fourth Amendment protections. Now, you might have other concerns, and certainly the law enforcement has many, many ways to overcome your Fourth Amendment privacy protections. And I think that's the principle that I get back to, which is law enforcement doesn't have just tied hands. If they approach a vehicle where there's a dead occupant and another participant, another passenger, that passenger can't just simply say, Fourth Amendment, please leave. Law enforcement can say, we have reasonable to, believe to suspect that criminal activity is afoot. We have all sorts of principles from exigent circumstances to obtaining a warrant to in many ways to abide by the Fourth Amendment that they have at their purview. But to simply say no protection, I'm not aware of any principle that would stand for that.
Did you want to touch on harmless error? One of the Commonwealth's arguments is, well, assuming they're properly in the residence, but shouldn't have gone further and opened any doors, nevertheless, the dead body would have been discovered under these circumstances, and so we don't need to articulate and any additional standard beyond the additional entry.
Yes, Your Honor, an inevitable discovery application that the Commonwealth is arguing, again, there's the two prongs that I'm still under the, operating under the presumption they still apply. The second prong, there's certainly no leads in law enforcement's capacity. But even if we go beyond that and similar to the Fourth Amendment, we just say it's a reasonableness standard. The facts that they put forward during the motion or a trial would certainly not be sufficient to raise beyond a presumption that they would likely have found this evidence. And not just this evidence, but this universe of evidence. The many conjectures and speculations that they would have to lead to say, well, this could have eventually been found. My client has to be afforded the same right to provide conjecture and speculation that maybe they would not have been found. I see my time has ended. If I could reserve the rest for rebuttal at this point.
2 minutes and 53 seconds. Ms. Fitzgerald, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. The police officer's actions in this case were reasonable and justified under either the emergency aid exception or the community caretaker doctrine. As everyone has acknowledged, these legal theories contain significant overlap, but they are distinct and both separately do apply in this case. Under the emergency aid exception, police officers may enter a home to provide emergency assistance, whenever they have a objectively reasonable belief that someone inside the apartment or inside the property is in need of immediate aid. And that's under the United States Supreme Court case in Brigham versus Stewart. And I know the defendant is not talking much about the initial entry into the apartment. However, the Commonwealth's position is that this was one continuous and ongoing emergency, and so the circumstances that brought the officers into this apartment are certainly relevant and should be considered when addressing the totality of their behavior here. And so looking at the officer's entry under the emergency aid exception, what we have is a request from the defendant's brother for a welfare check. He is concerned that the defendant may have harmed himself. He is in possession of, I think, what can be fairly described as a suicide note. The defendant talks about their deceased mother calling him, says he's sorry for his weakness. And following this, receiving this note, the family has been unable to contact him. When officers arrive, they are also unable to get him to come to the door to verify his wellness. Eventually, he stops responding at all, and then the officers hear that horrible noise coming from within the apartment. And at that point, I think the record amply supports that these officers had a reasonable belief that someone inside the apartment was in need of immediate aid. Once officers entered the apartment, of course, they see a man on the couch in the middle of a particularly violent suicide attempt. He's stabbing himself in the throat with a kitchen knife. The officers describe that he is resistive to aid. They have to wrestle the knife out of his hands. They apply immediate and life-saving medical help to him until EMTs arrive. And when the EMTs get there, one of the officers is still engaged in assisting them. They're performing a tracheotomy of the defendant on the couch. And in that moment, Officer Izzy has the opportunity to step aside and for the first time has the ability to look to see if there's anyone else in the apartment who might need aid. Within the confines of this very small one-bedroom apartment, he steps 3 to 4 feet to the side and opens a door to the only place he can't see from where he's standing. He immediately sees the victim on the floor, and significantly, he asks the EMTs to come give her aid as well. They, unfortunately, indicate that she is deceased. Officer Izzy's actions in this case were reasonable and appropriate in response to the ongoing emergency to which he was responding, that same emergency situation that led them to the apartment in the first place. Officer Izzy's actions were also reasonable in scope. He wasn't digging through kitchen cabinets or drawers. He simply, again, stepped 2 to 3 feet to the side within the confines of this small space to look and see the one place that he couldn't physically observe from where he was standing, see if there was anyone else in need of aid. And it's significant in this case.
Counsel, this is Justice Powell. Would it be the Commonwealth's position that if this had been, you've mentioned several times, the one bedroom, would it be the Commonwealth's position that if this was an 11-bedroom house that the officers could go from bedroom to bedroom seeking whether there was anyone else who might need aid?
Your Honor, I think it might be a more difficult question for the Commonwealth under those circumstances, but at least one other court considering that question, and that's the First Circuit in Najjar, has held that it was reasonable for the officers to look for victims in multiple bedrooms. Thereafter entering, the police officer found a woman in a first bedroom and then continued their cursory search to the other bedrooms, limiting their search to places, you know, where a victim may be. I was just going to conclude by saying, Your Honor, that I think it would be a more difficult case for the Commonwealth. But again, the ultimate question would be whether it was reasonable in relation to the nature of the emergency. And given the very limited intrusion here in the small confines of this space, I think that the facts of this case are better for the Commonwealth than they are in the hypothetical Your Honor proposed.
What the officers knew, and my facts, correct me if my facts are wrong, but what they knew is that the brother said, I believe my brother lives alone, and the vehicle, which was indeed registered to the victim, the brother said that my brother drives this car all the time. So he lived alone, and the car in the parking lot was a car that he drove all of the time. There is authority that says that the lack of information cannot provide the reasonable belief to do the sweep. So what they knew was that he probably lived alone, and this is the car that he drove. What then was the reasonableness that gave them the ability to open that bedroom door?
Your Honor, I have a couple of responses to your question. First factual, and then some case law that I think is analogous to this issue. So first, the officers did have information that the car the victim drove was registered to someone else and was in fact registered to the victim in this case, although we don't find that out until later. But whether or not the defendant lived alone, according to his brother, is not dispositive on the issue of whether there could be someone else in the apartment. Certainly, his brother ultimately testified that he hadn't been there in many months. He didn't know why his brother was driving a car that was registered to someone else, and the police were not required to take at face value, you know, when lives are at stake, the statement that he lives alone in this apartment. Again, it's not necessarily someone else who lives there at that time who could have been in the back bedroom. You know, it could have been anyone else. And I know that we are speaking here, in terms of mites, of possibilities, and I hear that in the court's question. And I would direct the court to United States Supreme Court case in Michigan versus Fisher, which is the case where the officers received a report of a man inside a house. The quote was that he was going crazy, he was in a rage, and he was throwing things. And in that case, the officers were justified in entering against his express wishes that they not enter, because his projectiles might have had a human target, like a spouse or a child. Might have had a human target. The officers in that case had no information that anyone else lived in that house. The defendant said, "Do not come into my house." And yet the officers were justified on going in because someone else in there may be in harm's way. And I think it's important in this context, when we are divorced from the criminal investigatory context, that the United States Supreme Court and the federal circuits who have considered this issue have given the police significantly I don't want to say more leeway, but they have not held the police to the same high standards that we commonly associate with officers acting in their criminal investigatory capacity under the Fourth Amendment. And we see this same theme happening in federal circuit courts, which, you know, obviously these are not binding on this court, but as this court has yet to address the issue, these are the cases relied on the Court of Appeals, and I think they do bear on the situation here. Obviously, our Fourth Amendment is coextensive with the federal Fourth Amendment, so I think these cases are instructive.
One thing that's different in this case, perhaps, is the extremely violent method used, a knife and self-stabbing by someone who plainly appears not to be in their right mind, as opposed to police are notified that someone who's terminally ill and once, you know, maybe takes a bunch of pills to just end the suffering from their terminal illness. So they come in and they see, oh, here's a suicide attempt by an elderly person who's got terminal cancer, as opposed to someone who is not in their right mind and stabbing themselves with a knife in the throat. So the method of suicide perhaps might give more latitude out of a concern for others in one scenario versus another.
Absolutely, Your Honor. This was a particularly violent and particularly gruesome suicide attempt. And the officers, I believe it was Officer Matterson that testified that they had just finished wrestling the knife out of his hand when the subsequent entry into the bedroom occurred. And again, it's not really an entry into the bedroom. He opened the door and looked in, and it was immediately there. We weren't searching through closets or anything like that. But yes, Your Honor, I absolutely agree that the particular nature of this suicide attempt colors and should color the officer's perception of what comes next and what else may be in this apartment.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. Isn't it more than that? Isn't it crucial? Because we don't have to go too far even in the news to know that many murderers end their spree by killing themselves. And this was, as was just pointed out, a gruesome attempt at suicide, which would raise a correlation to the possibility that same level of violence, if it's going to be perpetrated against himself, could have just minutes before be perpetrated anyone within his grasp. I mean, there's a powerful correlation there, isn't there?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, I agree. And certainly the officers in their role as peace officers here, they have an obligation to prevent violence and restore order. And I don't believe, especially under the situation of this extremely violent attempted suicide, that we can say they restored order and carried out their duties to prevent further violence without ensuring that no one else had been the victim of that extreme violence, or as the Court of Appeals hypothesized that there wasn't someone else in the room who may need care after the officers leave if they weren't a victim of violence themselves. But in that moment and in that emergency, and I think this goes back to whether the officers' actions were reasonable in relationship to the emergency they faced. Would they have been reasonable under Justice McCullough's hypothetical about an elderly person who took some pills? That would be a different question for a different case. But the violent nature of the suicide, the reasons for their entry in the apartment, the quick actions and the small space all considered together, the officers were acting reasonable given this emergency situation where they didn't have time to get the information they might have under other circumstances. With more time and not in an emergency, they would have pulled the lease, found the lease was registered in her name, the car outside was registered in her name, and her purse was on the table. So an officer who had the ability to step back and calmly deliberate, may have reached this different conclusion and one that would be more in line with what we think about when we think about the Fourth Amendment in an investigatory capacity. But these officers didn't have the luxury of time. And many courts in this context have noted that it's the duty of police officers and firefighters to act when lives are at stake. And that's what the officers in this case did.
Counsel, I have two questions. One, it appears that Michigan versus Fisher indicates that the emergency aid exception does not depend on the seriousness of the crime they are investigating when the emergency arises. Would that apply to this sweep of the bedroom, that pronouncement from Michigan, that whether you can search the bedroom doesn't apply to the seriousness? Your argument, obviously, is it, I guess it does not.
Your Honor, I'm not sure if I understand the court's question. So my understanding of the commentary in that case is the lower court found that this man had hurt his hand, and that simply wasn't a life-threatening emergency, and it didn't justify the police's entry because they didn't know someone's life was at stake. And the Supreme Court said no. He himself could be in need of immediate aid and could be so filled, you know, with rage and not have the wherewithal to get aid for himself. And so I think that statement was in the context of the court saying that when we're talking about an emergency, we're not requiring someone, to be on the brink of death. They cited to the Stewart versus Brigham City case, where there all the officers saw was someone had a split lip in the fight with the juvenile. So certainly officers do not need to have a life-threatening situation in order to be acting under this exception. However, where we do have a life-threatening situation, where we do have a situation of extreme violence, I would argue that justification would be even greater than when we have evidence of merely lesser injuries.
Let me ask a question about inevitable discovery. The second prong of inevitable discovery is that the leads making the discovery inevitable were possessed by the police at the time of the misconduct. Most of the leads making this discovery inevitable were known by the boss, the co-workers, but not the police. So why, I believe the Court of Appeals found that inevitable discovery applied. Why is that the case if these leads were not possessed by the police?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I believe the Court of Appeals declined to apply.
Declined. One of the alternative arguments that you're making.
Yes, Your Honor. It was, however, found by the trial court. And this court obviously has not had an opportunity to revisit inevitable discovery following Jones. But my reading of Jones, Your Honor, is that it rejected the Cherry test that the Court of Appeals had previously adopted, that three-part test, finding that Cherry was no longer good law in the Fifth Circuit, reverting to this court's precedent and also reverting to United States Supreme Court case law in Nix. And ultimately, then, the test for inevitable discovery was whether the Commonwealth could prove by a preponderance of evidence that this evidence would have inevitably come to light. Certainly, those prongs would make our job easier. But they are not necessary in order to meet the burden by a preponderance of evidence, is my understanding of Jones. And that's the theory the Commonwealth argued on. I agree with the court that factually the police did not possess those leads. Your Honor, I see my time is expiring. Would you permit me to finish your question?
Yes, go ahead. If you haven't finished the answer, Justice Powell, are you satisfied with the answer?
I would like for her to finish, please, Chief.
All right, go right ahead.
And so under those circumstances, Your Honor, the test being that the Commonwealth has to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that this evidence would have come to light without the police misconduct. The process for uncovering this body was already ongoing. The landlord significantly, she was supposed to be moving out of her apartment that day, had called her and emailed her repeatedly. Her lease was ended, and the landlord has a right of immediate access there. Further, her job, she was already missing, her coworkers were missing her, they were wondering where she was. She had a family that spoke with her every day, if not every week. But I think particularly that landlord, and in combination, her coworkers, the landlord, her family members, this is a body that would have been discovered within the two-week period when the defendant was in the hospital, and the Commonwealth has met that burden by a preponderance of the evidence.
All right, thank you very much. Mr. Moore, you have 2 minutes and 53 seconds left for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. If I could address some of those points, as was mentioned in one of the questions, I think it is most illustrated by Mincy v. Arizona, United States Supreme Court of 1978. The seriousness of the offense under investigation itself doesn't create exigent circumstances of the kind that under the Fourth Amendment that justify a warrantless search. And as other courts and other cases have shown, the seriousness of the act in dispute does not create an exception to the warrantless right or the Fourth Amendment. Mincy is a murder case. It was a violent case where many people were shot, including a police officer. And the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, said, look, that doesn't change the Fourth Amendment of the analysis. And that is what we're suggesting here.
Counsel, those are exigent circumstances case. They're not AIDS cases, emergency aid cases. And the standard for breaching the home and going in is in fact higher than the standard for protective sweeps or for cursory sweeps. So the fact that the standard for breaching the home for an emergency aid exception to the Fourth Amendment is allowable here, the next standard of doing a cursory sweep is a lower standard. And that's what the Sixth Circuit has said, the Tenth Circuit has said, and several other courts have said. Has anyone said anything differently?
Yes, Your Honor. There's a split amongst the country. This United States Supreme Court just last month and Cornelia versus Strom just heard oral argument on whether the community caretaker exception even applies to the home. So this is a argument that is ripe for discussion and is not a frivolous, you know, theoretical argument. The reason I bring up that...
What about the emergency aid exception?
The emergency aid exception, I think it's in dispute along the same spectrum. You have everything from clearly the warrant to the community caretaker on the other end and everything in between. And the reason the framework and whether it's emergency aid, exigent circumstances, or community caretaker matters is just as you suggest, the burden to go into a residence under exigent circumstances is higher. But when you do that, you're also afforded greater protections because as a police officer, you've identified reasonable, articulable facts that give you a reason to enter, and the courts are going to say, look, you're under greater danger, you're under a more immediate risk, you have a little bit broader power, including potentially a protective sweep if you arrest somebody. When you enter without that higher burden, and you're under the least possible burden of just, we're providing aid, we have the lowest burden to show as police to enter, then you have the least amount of authority and protection once you're inside. And that's what is so relevant in this case is, if inside, their power and their ability to do anything further is without support under law. I see my time is coming to a conclusion, so without any other questions from the court, I will conclude on that in my brief.
All right, thank you very much. The court will take an approximately 15-minute recess and resume at 10:40.